It took less than a minute for the inevitable. Hadrian finally guessed wrong, which left him late to block Falkirk's next blow. He managed to avoid the claws, but Hadrian lost his balance and fell with his back to Falkirk, leaving him exposed and blind to the next attack.
It's over.
The claws would enter the back of his neck. Hadrian wasn't certain if they could decapitate him, but that was also a possibility. Behind him, Falkirk made a muffled grunt, but Hadrian felt no pain. He didn't feel anything. Hadrian managed to twist around and saw the dead man lying on the floor halfway across the room. He howled in rage and struggled on his back as if pinned to the floor. A moment later, Falkirk appeared to shake off his invisible restraints. He focused on Hadrian and once more charged. This time, Falkirk raced at him on all fours, scraping the stone like a leopard. Hadrian raised his swords and braced himself for the impact. While still 20 feet away, the ruddy-haired remains were thrown sideways across the room as if hit by something. Falkirk rolled, then slid to a stop among the shattered debris created by the fallen cog.
Are you doing that, Royce?
Once more, Drumindor shook. More stones fell, and Hadrian smelled sulfur and felt tremendous heat. At first, he thought he was hot from exertion, but he realized he was mistaken when he noticed the walls glowing red. Time was running out. Hadrian ran for the master gear. He climbed the first and second teeth, which he was surprised to learn were covered in fresh blood. Reaching out for the third, something caught his boot and yanked. Hadrian was pulled down and he fell to the floor on his back, knocking the wind out of him. A weight landed on his chest as his arms and legs were pinned. Above him, Falkirk grinned.
It's too late. The spirits from the book annoy me, but they can't pull the lever. And the moon is up. It's over.
The grin opened, once more revealing his yellow teeth and black gums.
Such a pretty face.
Over the hunched back of Falkirk, Hadrian saw movement on top of the master gear.
Climb, you old fool!
When I said I wanted to hear you, lassie, I didn't mean I wanted to hear you scream.
Gravis pulled just as hard as he could to mount the final tooth. He was nearly out of strength. If he were honest with himself, he had actually passed that mark a while ago. Gravis was running on sheer determination now. Falkirk had lacerated his abdomen, and the cuts had been deep. He didn't dare look down. He didn't want to see his innards trailing out. How he managed to scale the gear was beyond his comprehension, nor did it hold much interest. None of it mattered. Even the condition of his ripped-open belly was inconsequential. He knew this beyond any doubt, because Ina told him so.
I don't care a fig if you don't like the tenor of my voice, Gravis. You dig in, your bearded boil on the butt of a baboon. You only need to do one lousy thing in your whole life. This is it. Don't you dare fail now. You say you love me, so prove it. Prove it to me now, you daffy old humpot. Stand up and pull that lever.
Gravis pushed to his knees. The world was swirling around him. The walls had gone red and were smoking. As far as Gravis could tell, Drumindor ought to have already blown. The moon had to be up by now, should have risen a while ago. And when its full pale light had kissed the walls, the grand old lady ought to have popped like a cork, ushering a new year of death and destruction.
Perhaps I underestimated the stubbornness of the great old lady.
Looking up, Gravis spotted the chain that dangled from the arm Taran. It swayed with the rocking of the tower. He raised his arm but couldn't reach it.
You've got to stand, love!
Gravis had absolutely no idea how she was there, and much like his astounding climb, he didn't much care. All that mattered was that she'd heard him, and he could see Ina on her knees by his side, cheering him on. She was a dainty thing in her white nightgown, young and beautiful, just as she had always been in his mind's eye.
For you, my love, I'll do anything.
Don't tell me. Show me.
Aye, that I will.
With every fiber of his body, and the last droplets of strength that remained in him, Gravis pushed to his feet. He caught the swinging chain, gripped it tight, and then as darkness folded in around his vision, he proceeded to wrap, wind, and bind the chain around his wrists.
I do love you, Ina. I always have.
Royce listened to the voices as he walked the long, dark bridge toward the dragon's mouth.
Riches beyond your imagination.
Royce kept walking as the molten lake bubbled and burst. The temperature was bad, but not horrific. The stone bridge shielded him from the worst of it. He could see the blurry waves of intense heat to either side. And when a spout of lava blew up high enough to reach the level of the bridge, he felt a blast like a furnace on that side. Breathing was easier than he expected. The air smelled like rotten eggs, but he wasn't gagging. There was a reason. The dwarfs had built in a ventilation system that pumped surface air, which circulated through the room, or at least along the bridge. Royce knew this because he felt a cool breeze that had no business being there. Entering that chamber, it seemed to be certain suicide, but feeling the fresh air, Royce was reminded that this was a forge, and dwarves had worked here. The conditions had to be bearable.
Iceboxes, doors, and now this. Little monsters will take over the world one day.
Through his ears, he heard what could best be described as teeth dragged across a sharp blade, but in his head, he heard...
We'll give you everlasting life, Royce.
They weren't thoughts, not really, but it was difficult for him to separate words from thoughts.
Can anyone think without words?
It must be possible. People without sight and hearing who couldn't read still think. He just didn't know how. What Royce experienced as he crossed that bridge did not impress him as words so much as a simple understanding, an idea that became clear in his head, which in his mind translated into words.
We will make you a god.
This one made him smile. Maybe the idea that something was speaking to him was only a hallucination brought on by heightened anxiety. Or perhaps he was experiencing a form of delirium stemming from the noxious fumes. He leaned toward the latter, but either way, he found the promises humorously off target.
Let me guess. To become a god, all I need to do is not destroy this book?
The chamber roared with a positive, affirming answer.
But I should just what? Sit down, take a nap, and wait for this whole place to be obliterated?
Again, the euphoric response. Royce reached the Haldor Gigan. The mouth was the size of a giant's cave, and the doors were closed and sealed by a massive metal bar that he had no hope of removing.
Oh, that's interesting. In order to become a god, all I must do is die. But let me ask you this. Who are you to create gods of men?
We are greater than gods.
Okay, prove it. You say that for me to receive my reward, I need to die. Fine. I'll do what you want if you prove that you are greater than a god by opening this furnace door.
Nothing happened.
Obey us, child of dirt, or you will pay.
Royce studied the furnace. Like most dwarven doors, these were ornate and subdivided. He spotted a small hook hanging off to the side of one of the smaller squares and saw the answer. The mouth of the dragon could be opened in a variety of ways. A tiny aperture, or a set of multiple squares, and all the way up to the giant chasm of the full mouth. Whatever size required was available. The bar was likely there as a safety precaution. Royce grabbed up the metal hook, and after catching it on the side of a relief image depicting a dwarf hitting an anvil with a hammer, he swung a door open. Foolishly standing directly in front of it, he was singed, and only his quick reflexes saved him from a severe burn. Royce raised the book. The chamber shuddered and groaned, and the lava pool splashed and churned as Royce tossed the diary of Falkirk into the Haldor Geigen, trying his best to do it in the same fashion as had been depicted in the painting. He wasn't taking any chances. Hadrian threw Falkirk off. The dead man's body hit the floor and slid a few feet. Hadrian rolled to his knees, awaiting the next attack, but Falkirk didn't move. He looked to be nothing more than a long, dead corpse. As he stared at it, Hadrian noticed it wasn't merely Falkirk who had stopped moving. The tower had grown still, and everything was quiet, at least for a moment. Royce appeared in the doorway just as the master gear rotated one tick, but that click resounded with authority, and once more the tower shook. Instantly, 100 other gears whirred to life. The big ones that never moved crept forward. The medium-sized wheels beat a determined pace, and the little cogs spun so fast that they sounded like a hive of bees.
You did it!
Royce looked up at the ceiling of gears that performed a show like a ballroom of couples putting on a grand dance.
I didn't do anything!
They both looked to the place where Gravis had fallen, and found only a pool of blood. A scarlet trail smeared its way across the floor and up the top teeth of the master gear. There, dangling from a chain attached to the retracted lever, the dwarf hung by a single wrist, limp and unmoving. They pulled him down, but Gravis Burling, the last of his bloodline, was dead. Still, his eyes were open, and on his face sat a smile. Gwendolyn de Lancey and Rin Purim sat beneath the stars outside Table by the Tea. Gwyn leaned forward with her elbows resting next to the steaming cup of blackleaf she had made for herself. She didn't think Olivia Montague would mind. Gwyn had put everything back the way she found it, and doubted Olivia would even notice. In doing so, she smiled to find all the silverware, cups, and plates hadn't been touched. Despite Olivia's offer, no one had taken a thing. Wren sat with his feet up in a chair across from Gwyn. The white of his fresh bandages peeked out beneath his shirt.
Where's the moon?
I'm certain it will be along.
Gwyn sipped the hot tea. Wren narrowed his eyes at her, his mouth turning up in amazement, tempered with a dash of disbelief.
You're so relaxed.
And you should be too. Getting all worked up isn't good for your recovery. You need peace and quiet. You should have gone back with Arcadius and Albert like I told you to.
I'd rather die, for real this time, than to do that to him again.
Gwyn nodded.
Very brave of you.
He scowled in return.
You don't mean that.
I do. Sort of. For you, this is still a question. We could die at any moment, so your decision to stay is very courageous.
But it's not heroic for you?
Gwyn smiled and shook her head.
How can you be so sure?
Experience.
Gwyn set her cup back down, then smiled.
Look. There's your moon.
What's wrong with it?
In the sky hung a dark circle that appeared nearly invisible and a tinge red. Gwyn herself would have been equally aghast if she hadn't already seen the sight through Wren's eyes. She had no idea what it meant, but knew it was nothing bad. Still, witnessing that blood-red disk, seeing it with her own eyes, made her wonder what was happening. Something amazing, certainly. Something in the realm of the divine. And it frightened her to think she was involved, possibly even the cause.
Will this make the gods notice me now?
The thought was terrifying. The moon had already been well above the horizon, revealing that she had risen unseen several minutes ago, draped in a dark and blood-colored cloak. Now as they watched, the moon peeled off her covering, exposing the familiar white light beneath. The pale radiance displayed storefronts, tables, and chairs, and for the first time, Gwyn discovered there were others at the dock. small groups standing silently around the boardwalk, watching. And then it happened. The night exploded in a magnificent burst of yellow-illuminated brilliance as Drumendor vented. Like a fountain of light, all 48 spouts fired, and dazzling streams of gold spewed in gorgeous arcs out into the ocean. The whole of the harbor lit up in its fantastic glow as gasps and screams turned to cheers that burst from the assembled crowd. Gwen watched all of them. What looked to be more than 1,000 dwarves and several dozen Mir, Kalaeans, and even a few Baron sailors mingled together, faces glowing with relief and delight. Fists were punched in the air, shouts of joy and leaps of exuberance were everywhere. Among the revelers, Gwen spotted Calvary Graxton, Jareb, Atten, Baba, Salin, and Amster, and not far away, Oberon, who did not cheer. He cried. Atten embraced Jareb. Mr. Parrot got down on his knees and kissed a lady dwarf. Hugging and kissing became something of an epidemic that spread through the crowd. Wren slammed his palm on the table, upsetting Gwen's tea. Then he rose to his feet and proceeded to hop up and down.
Stop that! You'll hurt yourself!
I did it!
Hugs and kisses shifted to dancing as the dwarfs began impromptu jigs with music provided by slaps, stomps, and voices that soon fell into rhythm. Incredibly, this strange assortment of people began to sing together. They started with the dwarven anthem, which the taller folk tried their best to lend voices to. Then the multitude rolled right into Khalid Portmore, which everyone knew by heart. Then came the Kalaean folk song, Old Ramar. And finally, Ibn Rin, a song Gwen had only heard sung by the Mir in the alleys of Wayward once a year. Hearing the song brought Atten to sobbing tears. As the spray from the spouts diminished and the golden light faded, the moon finally cast off her dark cloak and climbed the sky in her full circle of silvery splendor. And off in the distance, spilling down the cliffside from the high ridge, Gwen heard the lonesome howls of wolves. She thought this strange, as she wasn't aware they even had wolves in Delgos.
There she is. There's the lady of the evening. She arrives making a delayed but dramatic entrance that no one will ever forget.
Now I just have to hope that Hadrian doesn't hate me and will decide to kill me.
Then Wren looked at her.
He doesn't. Does he?
Gwen lifted her cup and sipped. Hadrian and Royce stepped out of the South Tower into a throng of deliriously happy people, each of whom had expected to be dead. Everyone had gathered at the water's edge to die together. Instead, they witnessed the fiery venting of twin towers that made tear-soaked cheeks glisten. By dawn, those who had fled on foot would likely see the venting from the Highland Plains and turn back. The Crown Jewel would also spot the spray and return by sunrise. But that first night was special. Everyone who stood on that boardwalk at moonrise had faced and accepted death together. The truth of their differences had been revealed by the darkness of that penultimate pause as absurd foolishness. And this clarity of understanding formed everlasting bonds. Dwarfs, elves, Kalaeans, subjects and the nobility of the Seven Kingdoms of Avern, and even Baron Gazelle were forever welded together by the great forge of Drumendor into a family, not of shared blood, but collective spirit. The returning residents would celebrate the survival of the city, but those who hadn't left experienced a transformative rebirth. Their lives, hearts, and minds forever changed. And every member of that unlikely tribe had witnessed Royce and Hadrian exit Drumendor. Gwen and Wren were waiting just outside the door to the South Tower, as if they knew in advance where Hadrian and Royce would be. This mystery was crushed by the reality that Gwen was there at all, and her presence was obliterated by seeing Wren alive. Joy, relief, exhaustion, bewilderment. It all blended together the way it sometimes did when he drank too much. He remembered hugging Ren and squeezing too hard, making the young man whelp. He recalled asking questions and not hearing the answers. And he remembered the full moon shining on them as somewhere in the distance a wolf howled. Then the crowd came in. They formed a circle and began expressing gratitude with words and handshakes, then with hugs, kisses, and tears. Sloane pulled Hadrian down and kissed him on the mouth. Mr. Parrot, who was openly sobbing, took Hadrian's hand as if to shake it, just held on and never said a word. Everyone felt a need to approach, to thank, to touch them as if to prove their saviors were real, or perhaps that they were only men. Oberon came last. His face was slick.
This is what it looks like to get tears out of a rock.
Thank you. I spent over 100 years trying to do what you managed in a single day.
Couldn't have done it without you.
I know. Strange how life works. You can spend your whole life pushing on a door only to realize it needs to be pulled. Did the two of you have a talk with Gravis?
Hadrian shook his head.
We only spoke with him.
Hadrian gestured at the skyward streams of lava that continued to spray but whose arcs were shortening.
He did that, not us. Him and his wife.
Oberon looked curious.
Just like in the mural. She was there helping him at the end. Apparently she'd been waiting for Gravis to join her.
Oberon looked down at the tattoo on his arm.
Maybe everyone is.
Seven days later, Hadrian watched the arrival of Hansen and Sons' stagecoach from a stool at the Drunken Sailor. He sat back with his elbows at the bar. The coach came to a stop at the statue of Anvari Burling. The sun of another beautiful day made the coach's filigree shine. Customers dressed in wool and clutching cloaks and blankets stepped out, grinning at the warmth. They wandered toward the docks in awe, staring at the ocean as if they'd never seen water before. Hadrian continued to sip his coffee, a brew that was both richer and fruitier than anything he'd known in Avren or Calais. It was also free. Everything was now. Royce had destroyed the Falkirk diary, ruining his chances of ever obtaining a permanent key to the city, and yet having one was no longer necessary. No matter where they went or what they asked for, every merchant, craftsman, donkey wagon driver, street vendor, and danthem owner refused payment, as those who stayed didn't feel they could ask any more from them. At first, Hadrian thought it was nice, but soon he found it awkward. Then, finally unpleasant when he discovered the generosity wasn't always voluntary. Those who hadn't lived through the night of the full moon were made to understand that anyone failing to treat the city's saviors with the proper reverence and respect would become pariahs. Hadrian began leaving tips, only to have them promptly handed back. One fellow went to the effort of chasing him down to return 4 copper coins, accusing Hadrian of trying to ruin him. Holding the last cup of coffee he wasn't allowed to pay for, which was served by a man who couldn't afford not to, Hadrian was thrilled to see the stagecoach. The golden sunshine of paradise had grown too bright to endure. The time had come to return to the comforting indifference of the cold, gray world that awaited beyond the horizon. He hoped that after a few years, new people would come to Tir Del Fur, and the old ones would forget what Rhaera had done, because Hadrian thought he would like to come back, but only if he could pay for his own drinks. By midday, Shelby and Heath had unloaded the last of the luggage, and the 4 travelers, a young couple and an older one, whom Hadrian imagined might be the wealthy parents of newlyweds, had hired a donkey wagon and were off climbing Burling's Way. Shelby folded back all 4 doors and went right to cleaning the interior of the coach, and Heath put feed bags on Jack and Rabbit. Shelby waved, finally spotting Hadrian.
Good day, sir.
Hello, Mr. Hansen. Heath.
Hadrian waved back, then drank the last of his coffee and dropped a stack of coppers on the bar before walking across to the coachman.
Ready to go home?
Adrian nodded.
Got room?
There are five of you, correct?
Nope, just three. Gwen, Royce, and myself.
Heath looked around.
What happened to the other two fellas?
They went back on the LSVAR nearly a week ago.
Shelby's eyes showed a troubled squint.
Had nothing to do with the Flying Lady. They were just in a hurry to leave.
Shelby nodded.
We heard there'd been some trouble down here.
Shelby looked around at the boardwalk, which was littered with homemade noisemakers, random bits of clothing, including a pair of shoes that hung from a pole, and discarded mugs of metal and wood. Adrian suspected the cups were less abandoned and more lost. All rules, formalities, customs, convention, and even quite a few laws had been ignored as the city celebrated its continued existence. The party that began just after the venting of Drumindor had continued unabated ever since, but the passion and mortal endurance was finally fading, and the celebration had dwindled to briefer periods of ebbs and flows.
Doesn't look so much like trouble as it does a celebration.
Narrowly averted trouble. So, do you have room to take us back?
We do indeed.
It will take us a few minutes to get our luggage down. Is that all right?
We are at your service.
You're certain you won't come back with us?
Hadrian and Wren stood beneath the lemon tree in the turquoise turtle's courtyard.
The church is still a threat.
The young man looked his old self again, his wound hidden by new clothes.
And according to Oberon, growing stronger every day. It isn't safe. But if you need me, I...
No.
Hadrian held up a hand.
Stay and be safe. It's enough to know that you're alive and doing well.
That remains to be seen.
Oberon appeared, wearing his straw hat with the blue feather and holding pruning shears.
I have my doubts that an ex-Averin noble can learn to do real work.
I will have your head spinning with my energy and dedication.
We'll see.
Oberon gave Hadrian a wink.
If you impress me, then when I take my long-delayed trip to see my family again, you will be responsible for all my holdings. They will be yours to care for.
How many places do you own?
Including the slip my Lorelei docks in.
He closed one eye as he calculated.
35.
You own 35 Rolkens?
Only 28 are Rolkens. The rest are shops I'd rent out, and I'm half-owner in a Dantham.
You must be rich.
Don't know, don't care. But it is a fair amount of work.
Oberon eyed Wren.
So, you'd better get well fast. I've got a lot to teach you in a short time, and I don't want everything I've built falling apart once I'm gone. You do what I say. Work hard and stay out of mischief, and one day, the name of Wren Purim will be known far and wide as a successful landowner and Turdel fir businessman.
Apprehension revealed itself on Wren's face, and he began to shake his head.
I don't think that is such a good idea.
You don't want to be successful?
I don't think it is healthy for Wren Purim to be known far and wide, especially if I'm seeking to stay out of mischief. I have enemies.
The old dwarf nodded and smiled.
You're not alone. That's how I ended up here. You might be surprised to learn that Oberon isn't my real name. When I came here, I left the old one up north along with everything it stood for. I planned to make a new life, one that included living. And that required a new name. Perhaps you might consider doing the same.
He clapped the young man lightly on the shoulder.
Just make sure it's a good name. Something memorable. Easy to say, and one you can be proud of.
Wren looked up at Hadrian, and that long-lost smile of pickles returned. Royce was late getting back. He hadn't expected the meeting to take so long. And while he wasn't concerned about the stagecoach leaving without him, he didn't like making Gwen worry. He still couldn't believe she had stayed behind. She said it was her idea, but Royce couldn't help believing Arcadius was the real culprit. The way Royce envisioned it, Arcadius was following the tried and true rule of three when he faked Rin's death for the second time. Arcadius bet that no one, especially not Hadrian, would believe the boy had died, so to ensure his deception, he had had the dwarven doctor administer some drug that simulated death before letting Hadrian see the body. Gwen likely believed that the end justified the means, so she was willing to participate in the ruse, but only for so long. She wasn't about to let the professor get away with it. She likely surmised that Hadrian would need proof, and a living, breathing Wren would be the only evidence he would accept. As such, she stayed behind with Wren. None of this was at all astounding. That Arcadius had lied and manipulated the entire party for his own mysterious motives could have been anticipated and expected. If Royce hadn't been so masterfully distracted, he would have realized the doddering professor was up to something. The full extent of exactly what that was remained a mystery. One thing was not in question. The old man's desire to read Falkirk's diary was a driving force, and Royce enjoyed the knowledge that he had deprived the professor of that pleasure. The truly crazy thing was that Gwen had stayed. She knew both the risks and the odds, and while it was one thing to say you believed in someone, it was a whole different world to push in all the chips and roll the dice. Gwen had a ticket to safety, but she had trusted Royce and bet her life on him. And miraculously, he had somehow managed to reward that faith.
No, I don't want Gwen to worry. Not anymore. She deserves better.
By the time Royce returned, the last of the luggage had been hoisted up and secured to the top of the coach. Oberon, Sloane, and Wren were there to see them off.
Well?
They accept. Or rather, Cornelius does, and the others agreed with him.
Only took merely losing the bleeding city to open their eyes.
As of now, all dwarfs are granted full citizenship. A dwarven council will be created, and its president will join the triumvirate in running not just this city, but all of Delgos. Also, after seeing the error of removing Gravis from his position, the administration of Drumindor will be awarded to the dwarven council, who will choose Lord Byron's successor. The trio will go over all this with you tomorrow in a meeting where you can work out the details. Then, next week, I think, they plan to hold a parade to celebrate the rebirth of Tir Del Fur. The procession will march down Burling's Way to the statue here. Supposedly, Cornelius Deleur will walk out and give a speech declaring all this.
Supposedly?
Royce smiled.
Does anyone here think the man can actually walk?
So? It's really going to happen.
Delore isn't a fool. He realizes now that he needs you to keep his city working. This event gives him the perfect opportunity to make a change without conflict or embarrassment.
Oberon looked at Sloane.
You did it, lass. You made them see us for who we really are.
We did it.
She narrowed her eyes sternly.
And don't be thinking you're done.
I am done. I finally helped make things better, and maybe this seed will bear fruit that can grow and spread.
Sure, sure. But I'll need your help. I can't be relying on the likes of Barak and Trigg to set up this council. And who are we going to pick to run Drumindor?
Oberon stared at her.
You're just trying to keep me alive.
I'm trying to make the world a better place for all Dromians.
You have to put it that way, don't you? Go right for the soft meat. Hit me when I'm all exposed and vulnerable.
Winning the peace isn't the hard part. Keeping it is.
Oberon sighed, then nodded.
Sloane, my sweet Belle.
He put his arm around her.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
The two waved their farewells and headed up Burling's Way toward what Royce assumed would be a celebration at Scram's Galley.
Is that what Cornelius wanted? Is that why you were called to a meeting?
No. He heard we were leaving and wanted to offer me a job.
Gwen, who had fashioned an overstuffed snack bag from a discarded patch of Oberon's fishing net, set it on the seat inside the coach.
Doing what?
Royce hesitated.
What I used to do.
Oh!
Gwen smiled, then her eyes widened.
Oh!
Says he'll set me up here. Give me a small palace on the first tier and a staff of servants to manage it. He also offered a generous salary. I was promised the life of a noble, a member of the landed gentry, a vassal to his lordship. I'd have prestige, power, fine clothes, and my own carriage.
Both Gwen and Hadrian stared at him.
What did you say?
Told him I already have a job. Watching out for the two of you. Turns out that's a full-time occupation. Also that sunshine and ocean waves don't agree with me. I like my cloak and my independence. From now on, if I kill someone, it's because I want them dead.
Okay.
Hadrian looked at Gwen and nodded approvingly.
I suppose we can chalk that up as a win, right?
Gwen smiled at Royce.
We're all set to go. Hop in, folks.
You're riding on top again, right, Hadrian?
What? There's only three of us. Coach seats four.
But you're riding on top because of how nice a day it is. You want to take advantage of the sunshine and blue skies before we hit the cold, cloudy weather of home? Isn't that right?
Hadrian glanced at Gwen, who said nothing. She merely grinned and rocked forward and back from her heels to her toes like an excited child.
Fine. But I'm coming in at the first sign of snow. And save some of those snacks for me, and not just the ground peas. There's some good stuff in there.
Royce opened the coach door for Gwen as Hadrian climbed up behind the driver's seat.
Nice to have you aboard again, sir.
Heath extended an arm and helped pull Hadrian up. As he did, Hadrian noticed a ring on Heath's hand.
That wasn't there before.
Heath grinned.
I finally found a girl with most of her fingers.
It's only been a month.
Heath shrugged.
When you know, you know.
She's a wonderful young lady. An absolute princess.
Meaning she's got four limbs, two eyes, and most of her fingers, right?
Meaning she said yes.
Oh, she's much more than all that. Her name is Winifred Plinth. But don't ever call her that. She goes by Winnie. Her father is a dairy farmer along our route, and we stop there frequently for milk, cheese, and to water our horses. And she thinks my life riding up and down the road is exotic and exciting. To her, I'm a worldly adventure, a hero.
Well, congratulations. She sounds wonderful.
Shelby released the brake.
How about you, Hadrian? Any rings in your future?
Hadrian frowned.
For a while, I thought there might be. But I was wrong.
Didn't have all her fingers.
Hadrian thought about it and shook his head.
No, she just wasn't the one.
Shelby turned the coach around.
No one is perfect, son. Don't be so picky and don't wait too long. Time is a funny thing. One minute it seems you have forever, then the next you think it's too late. But it's never too late, Hadrian. Remember that. The world could be coming to an end, and it still wouldn't be too late.
Oh, it's too late, I'm afraid. The world as we knew it already ended. Royce Melbourne finally kissed Gwen Delancey. I'm surprised there is still a sun in the sky.
I heard that.
I know.
Shelby drove the team up Burling's Way toward the Highland, to the north. Toward that thin gray line on the horizon where color faded to a dull gray and men faced the consequences of bad decisions. Rhaera was going home.
The Rhaera Chronicles, Volume 5, Drumindor, by Michael J. Sullivan, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2024 by Michael J. Sullivan, Rhaera Enterprises, LLC. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2025, Graphic Audio, LLC. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication is prohibited. Adapted for graphic audio and directed by Bradley Foster Smith. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Molly Creerand and Kobe R. Jameson. Narrated by Bradley Foster Smith. Featuring Danny Gavigan as Royce, Chris Gennebach as Hadrian, Terrence Aselford as Albert and Arcadius, Nora Ashradi as Gwen, Andrew James Spooner as Oberon, Bradley Foster Smith as Gravis, Jenna Sharp as Constance and Opal, and Zura Johnson as Sloane, with additional performances by Peter Holdway, Emlyn McFarland, Stuart Crank, Chris Davenport, Christopher Tester, Nathaniel Priestley, Kay Alluvian, Joe Mallon, Matthew McGee, RJ Bailey, Rose Elizabeth Supan, James Lewis, Matthew Bassett, Michael John Casey, Nanette Savard, Rob Moreira, David Arden Engel, Wynn Delano, Danielle Cohen, Donald Guzzi, Kimberly Cochran, Christopher Walker, Jonathan David Bullock, Hedra Knight, Damon Allams, Dawn Ursula, Steve Winall, Holly Adams, Eric Messner, Drew Kopis, Richard Rowan, Kimberly Cochran, Mort Shelby, and Jessica Schley. Theme music by David Zitney. Original music by Jameson Hunt and Bradley Foster Smith. Produced by Colleen Delaney, Scott McCormick, David Zitney, Casey Green, and Aaron Coe. Executive producers Angie Cornett, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. Keep listening to hear a sample clip from Terra Ignota Book 1, Two Like the Lightning, by Ada Palmer.
We're gonna break our record,
Cato boasted to the house over their tracker link.
Thisbe, is there someone down there with you? I'm getting a stray signal.
It's that Senseiir again. I knew it!
Yes, our Senseiir's back again. Carlisle, I called them.
Again? Smitten! I knew it!
I appreciate the vote of confidence, Eureka, but it's really just a session. They're very good.
I'm sure.
Not like that.
Everyone carry on with the drill like all's normal.
What? Is there a problem?
The police called. Not our police. Romanova, Polylaws.
Making a fuss?
Someone's using the Canna device.
The Canna device?
They've been watching for it. Someone activated it. Here, right in the house.
Just now?
11 minutes ago.
11? Just before the drill?
Getting my boots now.
Who ordered this drill?
I can't confirm.
Cato, take over the automated systems. Don't let anyone know we're taking action. Just have something aimed at every non-Bash member in the house. If anyone tries to leave, move, or access equipment, then slow them down. Make doors stick, lights fail, robots seem to malfunction. Don't let anyone realize you're doing anything, but slow them down.
On it.
Cardi, keep on as officer on duty. Go down with the drill captain and start checking off the levels one by one.
On it. Whose gray pants are these behind the couch, and can I borrow them?
Mine. Go ahead.
Eureka, assemble a master list of everyone who's here. See if there have been substitutions. No one should be here who hasn't had a background check a kilometer deep.
I didn't see any unfamiliar faces.
Me neither.
All IDs check out.
Entering Green Wing elevator now. Occam, where are you?
Still upstairs with Leslie. We won't move until we know what's happening.
I see 12 people out of position, mostly near each other. Four groups of three moving fast, upper tiers, just under the house. They look like they're searching.
ID them.
On it. Should I take them out? I have clear shots on all 12.
Are they a threat to the system where they are?
No, they're nowhere near controls, not a vulnerable area. Whatever they want, it isn't the system. They're definitely searching, systematically.
Who are they?
Attachment.
Cato, do you see the Canna device? Do they have it?
If anyone knew what a Canna device looked like, that question might mean something.
They might be searching for the device if it was used here.
You brought Mycroft here in the first place, Thisbe.
Bicker later. Cato, do they have any tech you can't identify?
Checking. Nothing extraordinary.
Incoming cars. Not our cars. Emergency system. Police.
Reinforcements?
Whose?
Checking.
Where these stray 12, Cato? Give me a location. I'll flush them out.
Not yet, Thisbe. I want to watch them. Cato, show me.
Thanks for listening to this Graphic Audio production. Graphic Audio has over 1,700 titles to choose from. Listen to over 225 binge-worthy series. We feature titles in genres like science fiction, fantasy, romanticy, westerns, mystery thrillers, comics, and more. Check out our exclusive series such as Deathlands, Rogue Angel, Outlanders, Tangent Knights, and Agent of Exiles, which are only available in our dramatized adaptation format. Experience a radically different type of audiobook produced with a full cast, sound effects, and cinematic music. Listen to a movie in your mind, on the go, anytime, anywhere. Our dramatized adaptation titles are available at all major audiobook retailers and platforms. Sign up for our email newsletter for the latest updates and new releases. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and other social platforms. For more information and samples of all our titles, visit our website at graphicaudio.net.